Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this episode, we'll highlight some research done in recent years at the UC Davis Bodega Marine Laboratory on the Northern California coast. Later on in the show, we'll talk about mapping the effects of ocean acidification on marine life on the Pacific coast with UC Berkeley Professor Rachel Carlson. But first, we find out about an amazing scientific detective story with roots at Bodega Bay just before World War II with marine biologist Emily Longman. Longman is a professor at the University of Vermont and earned her PhD at UC Davis. She was part of an amazing study conducted after an unpublished study of a Bodega Bay mussel colony from 1941 was discovered in the university's library. After identifying the exact location that the study was conducted at just before America's entry into World War II, Longman and her team returned to the site to see how the mussels and other marine life were faring 8 decades later. Dr. Longman joins us now from her home in Vermont. Emily Longman, welcome to Blue Dot.
Great to be here.
When you were at UC Davis, tell us about, you know, what you were studying and where.
Yeah, so for my PhD, I worked at UC Davis's Bodega Marine Laboratory, which is along the Northern California coast. And I'm really interested in studying patterns of adaptation in marine organisms and looking at community change. So I did a lot of fieldwork when I was out there, and one of my projects was diving into a historical ecology project.
Was it you that ran across this paper from 1941? Tell us the story about how you discovered this research from almost 80 years prior to your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sadly, no, I was not the person to initially find this report. Although I did spend a lot of time in the Cadet Pan Library, which is the library at the Marine Lab. It's a gorgeous library that's a really great place to do lots of work and writing and coding and things. So I had spent lots of time in there. But actually, the person who first found the report was Jackie Soans, who's the research coordinator at the Marine Lab. She had been looking through the shelves to see if there were any interesting old reports, mostly because we've used old reports as ideas for like undergraduate student projects over the summer. So she was kind of looking through the shelves to see if there would be anything interesting, and stumbled upon this 1941 report by Harvey I. Fisher and Milton Hildebrand, which was just a treasure trove of data and about as good as you can get for a historical report that's so quantitative and comprehensive.
Okay, well, let's take a little bit of a deep dive, if you will, even though mussels don't require you to take a deep dive when you're doing oceanography and marine biology. They're right there on the shore. But when you first found out about this, tell us about this report that these two young men did right before the attack on Pearl Harbor was when it was published, is my understanding. Milton Hildebrand and Harvey Fisher. Tell us what they were working on and where.
Yeah, so these two students were graduate students at UC Berkeley at the time, and they were required to take a couple field classes as part of their graduate degree. So they decided to both take a marine invertebrate biology course that was based at the coast at Dillon Beach. And so as part of their project, or as part of their summer, they were doing a project together looking at mussel bed communities at Dillon Beach. So they did a really comprehensive survey of all of the interesting little critters and organisms that live within mussel beds.
Let's do a little mussels 101, if you will, because I'm very familiar with them, having grown up in Southern California on the coast there at the beach. And we used to collect them and eat them when I was a kid. They're really tasty. But they're really an important species. They're actually extremely important, a keystone species. And we can talk about what that means. But tell us about mussels. What is their role in the ecosystems that they inhabit?
Yeah, so mussels are really, really important species. They're foundation species rather than kind of semantics, rather than keystone species. But foundation species are species like corals and kelps and seagrasses that create habitat for other organisms. So mussels, the main mussel along the West Coast is the California mussel. And they kind of vary in sizes, but can grow to be really big. But the thing that's really interesting about them is that they attach together to create this really three-dimensional habitat where all these other animals can live in the kind of like nooks and crannies in between the mussels. And these mussels provide tons of other helpful benefits to these organisms living there, such as kind of keeping them cool and keeping some kind of water in there, and so keeping them a little damp, among other things. So mussels are really important to kind of increasing biodiversity along the coast of California.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit more about mussels and what's going on with mussels, because what I've read in the past is that mussels are kind of on the decline in Southern California. There's been some problems. Tell us a bit about what we're observing on the California coast, Southern California versus where you were sampling and where you're studying there in Bodega Bay.
Yeah, so there had been some previous research out in Southern California showing that biodiversity in mussel beds has been decreasing really drastically. So when I started this project, I was expecting to find something similar. And luckily, I actually didn't find that, which is a kind of very nice, positive, bright spot among a lot of usual findings that are really negative right now. But we actually found that these mussel beds in Northern California appear to be really healthy. They're still very multi-layered beds with tons of organisms living within these habitats. And so we actually didn't see a decline in diversity in Northern California.
And when you went and surveyed this spot, did you know about the study prior to going there? Or was it after you saw the study that you decided to survey this exact spot?
You mean the 1941 study or the...
Yes, the 1941 study. Did you find out about that and decide, let's go look at that spot and see what's going on there now?
Yeah, exactly. So we found this report and it just seemed so perfect of a historical resource. So the field of historical ecology is a pretty growing field where scientists are using non-traditional resources like museum collections or old maps and photographs or species lists from field surveys, as well as like indigenous knowledge and other information that's not published. So this was a 1941 report that was not published. It was just a report that was being housed in the Cadet Hand Library at the Marine Lab. And it seemed so perfect because it was a really quantitative survey that the students counted and measured every single organism living within this mussel bed. But beyond having like really quantitative data, they included lots of great maps and pictures that felt like you could find the exact spot that the students surveyed. And we had used Dillon Beach as a site for other research. And so we decided to head out and try to find the exact sampling spots that these students surveyed in 1941.
And when you got there, was it like, aha, yes, this is the spot, where you could tell, you know, exactly from their paper and their illustrations and what you were seeing, you know, in real time now, that this was exactly the same spot?
Yeah, definitely took a little bit of time. That area, there's a lot of these kind of boulder fields, of these little sections of boulder fields and then some beaches. So it took a little bit to figure out exactly where it is. But once we were like, I'm pretty sure in the right spot, and we were looking around on the rocks, once our eyes fell upon the boulder that these students studied, it was pretty clear. We had brought out a picture printed out that was from the student report showing that rock, and it looked almost identical to what it looked like today, which is shocking because there could be so many things that could have changed that rock over the course of time. But because it looked so similar and the mussel beds still looked really kind of abundant on there, it seemed like it was possible to see how things have changed. And it wasn't just due to kind of change in the rock size or kind of other disturbances.
And when you were looking at doing your own survey, you also found that there was an increase in biodiversity, was kind of the headline that I saw. How shocked were you to find that?
Yeah, we did find more species than the 1941 survey. So there was a in our eyes, an increase in biodiversity, but it is a little hard to fully show that without having more replicates. But we did find more species. The kind of increase seems to mostly possibly be due to species that were really low in abundance. So it could be possible that the students maybe missed one species when there was only one of them. But we do seem to find more species at this moment. It's hard to really know exactly how much that is true. The main thing that we can conclude is that there hasn't been at least a decline in biodiversity. We would probably need a couple more historical reports to resurvey to fully prove if there had been an increase. But that's me as my experimental design kind of hat on as a scientist saying that.
Yeah. And Eric Sanford, who was a professor there at Bodega and was also one of the authors on this paper and study, he made a comment I thought was really interesting. He said that the mussel beds are like a Motel 6 for all of these different species. Can you kind of give us a sense of how many different marine creatures live within these mussel beds and how important they are for them?
Yeah, I love Eric's comments. So Eric was my PhD advisor when I did graduate school at the Marine Lab. And so mussels, because they kind of attach together, they create all of these tiny little nooks and crannies and holes where all of these organisms can live within. And a lot of work has shown that there can be hundreds of species that live within these mussel beds. And the mussels create lots of big they vary in sizes that create then this kind of complexity in terms of gaps of different sizes and kind of different sediments and things. So you can get a range of organisms from things like crabs and snails and sea cucumbers and worms and sea anemones, among other things in there. And so really it's when you start pulling back some of the mussels that you start seeing this massive amount of biodiversity just kind of just underneath the surface, which is really exciting. So when you start ripping it up or kind of pulling up some of the mussels, you start seeing lots of critters move around.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you're in a river, for example, and you pull up a rock, it just looks like there's nothing living there. But you turn the rock over and there's all kinds of stuff living under those rocks.
Exactly. And these animals do move around a lot more when the tide comes up. So these mussels are in that intertidal zone. So they're in an area where part of the time they're covered by water and part of the time they're exposed to the air. And for me, it's much easier to access as a scientist when the water is out. And so it's at low tide. And that's when I go out and do the field work. But those are the times when the animals themselves are not moving around as much unless you start disturbing them a little bit. But when the water is up, they move around a lot more. And there's a lot more kind of movement in life in these mussel beds or observable life.
Yeah, the mussels themselves are really interesting too, because they, when they're exposed to the air, because like you said, they're in the intertidal zone where the tide comes in and the water's up covering them and then it's down and they're exposed to the air, that they clamp up. And so they're closed up very tightly when they're exposed to air. But it's really neat to watch them when they get exposed to the water and then they open up and they start, you know, they mm-hmm. start feeding. Tell us how mussels eat.
Yeah, so mussels are filter feeders. So they take water in and then filter that water to collect their nutrients. So it can be a really fun thing to kind of watch them open up and take in that water. And it's very similar. And if you get the chance to also watch a barnacle feeding, a barnacle is very similar, but a little bit more obvious because they put up this big, essentially like tent or kind of fan, I guess you would say, and then collect water and collect food particles and then bring them in. And so both barnacles and mussels are filter feeders. And so they're bringing food in via the water. And they can actually be really helpful for also kind of cleaning water by collecting those food particles and filtering the water.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with marine biologist Emily Longman as we discuss the history and science detective story she helped unravel about a colony of mussels on the Northern California coast. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with Emily Longman. Emily is now a marine biologist and professor at the University of Vermont, but we're discussing a fascinating study she and her colleagues did on a mussel bed near UC Davis's Bodega Marine Laboratory, where she did her PhD work. Longman used a recently discovered unpublished paper by two young undergraduate students who surveyed the site just before America's entry into World War II. And when you did your study, were you aware that Milton Hildebrand was still alive? When did you find out that he's still around?
No, I didn't. So yeah, the beginning of this project started by finding this report, but we had no idea that one of the students from this 1941 report that happened just before World War II was still alive. If anything, when we were doing the surveying, it kind of became a joke between Eric and I that we should come or try to find the students to get them to come help us, because they must still remember all of these animals, and we really needed extra hands, because a lot of field work for marine research is getting up at like 4 or 5 in the morning and going out at low tide. And then I was spending hours looking under our microscopes, sorting all of these species and identifying all of these animals. So Eric, Sanford and I kept joking that we should get some more helpers, and maybe Harvey and Milton would like to help. So we actually had no idea when we started this project that Milton Hildebrand was still alive and that he was a professor.
How did you find out that he's still alive? When did you discover that?
Yeah, so it wasn't until after we had finished like the main collections for this project, and we were talking about our research findings with another professor at UC Davis, Rick Grossberg, or now Professor Emeritus at UC Davis. And he was like, Milton Hildebrand, I know that name. And he was like, could this be the same person? And so he was the one who actually mentioned that Milton Hildebrand had been a professor at UC Davis and was still living in Davis. He was actually in the same department that Eric Sanford was. But Eric hadn't known Milton. Milton had retired before Eric Sanford had been hired. So they didn't overlap. And so he wasn't aware that he had been in the same department.
Then when did you actually find out that you could go talk to him? Because you got to go meet him and visit with him, didn't you? Tell us about that, because that's such a wonderful story.
Yeah. So once we found out that Milton had been a professor at Davis, and we thought he had still been living in the Davis area, we started reaching out to people to figure out if we could get connected to him. So we ended up getting in touch with his son, Ross, who said that Milton would likely be very welcoming and happy to see us. So we made a trip over to meet him, and actually brought with us his original 1941 student report to show him. And he was just such a joy to talk to. He was so thrilled to hear about our research findings and that we used his 1941 report as the kind of basis for our research.
And when you visited him, that was, I think, in 2019, he was 101 years old. He's sadly no longer with us, but that must have just been amazing. Did he, have any, vivid memories of doing this work?
Yeah, so he was like a couple weeks before his 101st. He got to 101. Wow. He was 100 years old, and to be honest, he looked amazing for his age. He was still very sharp and with it, and very kind of like mobile, and looked like very amazing. And so we had a really fun and lively discussion about the research. He didn't have super clear memories of doing this research. I think that was because mostly those memories seemed to be kind of covered up by serving in World War II. So not long after he took this class, he got drafted and served in World War II in the mountains in Italy. And so he had really clear memories, actually, of being in the war. And he told us some really fascinating stories about that time. And he remembered some of kind of spending time at Dillon Beach, but not all of the specifics, which I think we can let slide given that it was certainly over 100 years old.
Can you share with us anything that pops to mind, that one of his stories that he told you about serving in Italy? Because that was some pretty brutal fighting there.
Yeah. So he did a lot actually carrying supplies through the mountains. So he had done a lot of backpacking and hiking as a kid. So he was really comfortable kind of with using maps and compass and directions. And so he actually was leading troops and carrying supplies up and over through the mountains in Italy. And he actually saw some fighting. And so he could really clearly tell you about a lot of the times when he was strapping kind of equipment and stuff on kind of donkeys and other animals to bring weapons and supplies and food to other troops.
And when you showed him what you were doing and his original paper, what was his reaction to find out that, you know, you had used his work to you know, replicate it and to see what was going on today? What was his reaction to all that?
He was so thrilled when he found out that we used this report that he had done as the basis for our work. He was a really accomplished scientist, not in marine biology, but in vertebrate morphology. So he studied things like horses' gaits or how cheetahs run really fast. And so he was a really accomplished scientist and still was really interested in science. And so when we told him that we had used a report that he had done early in graduate school as a basis for our research, he just thought that was so fascinating and interesting. And it was felt kind of serendipitous in some ways, because in the actual report itself, there was a line at the very end that said, we hope our paper may serve as a basis for an ecological study of the area by ourselves or others at a later date. And so even in the report, they kind of were hoping someone would go back, whether it be them or someone else. And you could see how happy he was that we used this research for our own study.
Oh my, that's just amazing to think about that statement at the end of the paper, because, you know, little did they know 80 years later, you would be publishing this important work. This is just what an amazing story. It's almost like a movie. This is so cool. Let's get back to the mussels themselves and what you observed. We, of course, the oceans are warming, and that's measurable. Could you tell us about the role that the warming of the ocean water off the Pacific coast and acidification is playing in, you know, what we're observing as far as mussel species? You're seeing more. Are we seeing more of the southern type of mussels moving to the north? What are we seeing?
Yeah. So, climate change is resulting in a ton of changes to the coastal ecosystems, as well as kind of the offshore ecosystems along California. Water temperatures are rising, and we actually had some data going back to the 50s from the marine lab showing that Northern California temperatures seem to be increasing. And on top of that, waters are acidifying, and there's also tons of other more complex things happening in terms of changes with productivity. So the California current is a really well-known system in terms of being highly productive because of upwelling. So during kind of the springtime, upwelling is a process that there's deep ocean water gets brought to the surface, and that's really nutrient rich. And it results in this like really productive coastal ecosystems. And it seems like climate change is impacting kind of the patterns of upwelling along the coast, where changes, particularly in Southern California compared to Northern California.
And when you look back at what Hildebrand did back then with Harvey Fisher and what they observed and what you see now. Is there kind of groundbreaking work as far as are we able to suss out from, you know, early papers? Is how, I guess my question is, how rare is this to be able to go back and find a paper like this from long ago and then go back to the same site and compare things?
Sadly, it's pretty rare to have it be like such a perfect historical resource. The fact that we were able to find the same exact rock that these students studied was so helpful because it means that we're looking in the same location. We're not even looking in like at a different kind of elevation or a kind of different direction or anything. And so the fact that we were able to find the same rock is amazing. And beyond that, the fact that these students counted and measured every single muscle, as well as like identified all of the organisms, that is about as perfect as you can get in terms of historical resources. But I would like to think that there's a ton of useful data that you can get from many different forms of historical resources. In many cases, we don't have good information about the past state of ecosystems. And we know that many of these places are being increasingly threatened by climate change and other human impacts. And so kind of understanding what the past state of these ecosystems are is super, super important. And so I think scientists kind of using more historical resources in whatever forms you can find them, from museum collections to unpublished reports like this one in a library, they can be really good insights into what the past state of these ecosystems were.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself before talking to you, and it's like, I wonder if people are going to see your paper and look at this incredible story and start thinking, I wonder what I can find in some libraries, you know, where there's probably other papers, you know, that people have not paid attention in many years that, you know, actually could yield some really incredible data and interesting ways to compare through time what's going on, you know, with our ecosystems on the coast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just a little work to kind of shuffle through some old papers and reports in the library, but there are definitely possibilities to find or good reports that you can find. And there's also kind of other ways that you can go about this, whether it be looking at like old museum collections or thinking about like traditional ecological indigenous knowledge. Those can be great sources of information as well about the past states of ecosystems.
And mussels, of course, are, you know, found along the California coast, the Pacific coast, and in tide pools. And they're just such wonderful places to go explore. But there's also the danger that, you know, we're kind of loving these places to death by wanting to go check out all the tide pools and constantly be in them. Could you maybe tell us about, you know, what some of the impacts are of just people going out and, you know, exploring tide pools?
I love tide pooling as a marine ecologist. I get to do it on a like almost daily basis a lot of the time. And that's definitely what inspired me to go into this field. And so I do want to encourage people to go tide pooling, but there are ways to do it where you're not disrupting the ecosystems. If you're picking up animals, you should put them back down where they are. And you should be really careful when you're walking around. There has been some work in particularly Southern California that has shown that kind of just even the human impacts of trampling can impact and hurt mussel beds, but even other kind of actions like harvesting organisms can hurt the biodiversity in these beds as well. So you should get inspired by these ecosystems, but yeah, we definitely want to still protect them and not disturb them by means of other human impacts.
Yeah, so don't just go trampling and picking things up constantly and collecting and, you know, just tread lightly.
Exactly.
Well, Emily, it's just been wonderful to talk to you about this story. It makes me think of John Steinbeck and his good friend Ed Ricketts, the legendary marine biologist. I bet they would have loved this story.
Yeah, there's actually some similar research that has happened kind of in that area of Monterey where Ed Ricketts and Steinbeck had been, where there's a kind of transect along the Hopkins Marine Station where students have been resampling that over decades, and they found some really interesting findings, fairly similar to mine in terms of changing species composition, where you're having increases in kind of more southern species and decreases in more northern or cool adapted species. But yeah, there's some really fascinating work in the Monterey area as well.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite books of all time is their account of their journey to the Sea of Cortez in Baja. That's just such a classic book and so interesting, and it gives you such an insight into what, you know, what marine biology is all about and what it was like back in the 1940s.
Yeah, exactly. Those kind of things are the exact type of thing that we're talking about in terms of historical ecology and kind of just going out and being curious and looking at things, whether it be scientists and authors and writers, you can observe a lot of really important things that by writing it down can be good sources of data later on.
And any further research going to happen along these lines that you know of?
I think this has encouraged some more people to look in some of the libraries in Northern California. I don't think anyone has any immediate plans, but I really hope that this does inspire more people to do similar studies.
And what did you find most rewarding about your work on this?
It's a little hard. I would say probably the most rewarding scientific finding is just the fact that these mussel beds seem to be really healthy and support really a rich community of organisms. But I kind of have to say at the same time, really the best part of this was having everything come so full circle and getting to meet Milton Hildebrand. The fact that this is a historical report, being able to actually meet one of the authors and kind of have such kind of a complete story with this just is so special and rewarding and is not something that's usually common in science.
Yes, it's a fascinating scientific story and just a wonderful human story. It's quite lovely. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, so great to talk to you.
Thanks to our guest, marine biologist and evolutionary ecologist at the University of Vermont, Emily Longman. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll visit with another marine science researcher about mapping ocean acidification on the California coast. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. We're now joined by Rachel Carlson. Rachel is an assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management, and she joins us now to talk about her work mapping ocean acidification off the California coast. Rachel Carlson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've been doing some interesting work on ocean acidification, but before we get to that, I'd like to know a little bit about your career path. You were at UC Davis, and I'd like you to tell us about, you know, how you got interested in these topics and how you got there first.
Yeah, I had a bit of a meandering path to marine science. I started off with degrees in English and in civil engineering, and so to sort of unlike fields. And I've always been drawn to research that kind of touches on the human condition, human stories, like with this English degree. But also I've always loved ecosystems and scientific analysis and kind of immersing myself in field work. And eventually I found my way into geospatial science, which is essentially the science of maps and using geospatial science to study environmental change. And I was really drawn to that specific field because I think maps are a very effective medium for organizing complex environmental data, for understanding the world around us, but they're also a very good tool for communicating stories. And I think most people, if they look at a spreadsheet of 10,000 rows of data, can't really see themselves, place themselves in that spreadsheet, but most people can place themselves on a map. And so I became really curious about different technologies for using mapping tools to analyze spatial ecosystem data and make those data available to people. And So I worked for a while at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA in D.C. I worked in some policy roles, and I kept coming back to these research questions again and again that I was curious to answer. And so that led me back to academia and to working at UC Davis and to a PhD. And I just kind of kept going from there. I found that I was able to use these mapping tools to connect science to applied kind of on the ground conservation. And so I stuck with it.
And when you were studying ocean acidification originally, was that at the Bodega Marine Laboratory?
It was, yeah. I have studied a few different kind of climate change phenomena, heat waves on coral reefs in Hawaii in my PhD, and then focused on ocean acidification in my postdoctoral fellowship at UC Davis.
And then tell us about how you got to your professorship that you have at UC Berkeley. That's a pretty prestigious institution.
Yeah, I think that I just really enjoy the process of mentoring students. And I think that we are at an inflection point in action on many environmental issues. And so the ability to work with students in the earliest part of their career in the environmental space is a very privileged role to have. And I feel very inspired by students on a daily basis. And so that kind of interaction made it very difficult to imagine leaving academia.
And you've been doing some studies on ocean acidification, so let's kind of start there. Can you give us a basic explanation of what are the interactions that go on between the ocean and the atmosphere that lead to the ocean water becoming more acidic?
Yeah, so carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing, and that is the major driver of climate change from the burning of fossil fuels. And as CO2 molecules increase in the atmosphere, a lot of that gets into the ocean. About a third, or 27% really, of CO2 in the atmosphere gets absorbed by the ocean. And so as carbon emissions go up, carbon dioxide in the ocean also goes up. And once in the water, the CO2 combines with H2O to kind of set off a series of chemical reactions that have the end result of driving up hydrogen ions, H+, in the water. And I think sometimes when we talk about pH, we think of lemons and baking soda and these kind of things that are a bit removed from just one basic ion. But pH is basically a measure of how many hydrogen ions are in the water. And so as H+ goes up from this series of chemical reactions, the water gets more acidic, pH goes down. And that is sort of the nuts and bolts of what we call ocean acidification.
Yeah, it's basically just a proton, which is positively charged, attaches itself to a water molecule and makes it positively charged, called the hydronium ion. And that's the excess of that, when that's out of balance with the opposite, OH-, you have an acid. So in the ocean, how acidic are the oceans, say, off the California coast? What kind of acidity are we talking about?
So it varies quite a bit depending on where you're looking. And change in pH is very gradual, but sometimes, especially during upwelling events or during events of kind of a high input of nutrients into the ocean from the land, you might get larger changes. But it is very dependent on where exactly you're looking at. There can be local factors that affect the pH within any given kind of kilometer or stretch of coastline. Ocean water is typically quite basic, so between 7.8 and 8.4. So too far below that kind of 7.8 lower end of the range is getting into kind of a problem area. But there is a lot of variability depending on whether there's, kind of a recent upwelling event or a recent event bringing a lot of kind of harmful nutrients from land-based pollution into the ocean. So it's hard to say, kind of a steady average pH, but we are seeing that there is a kind of steady decline.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you go in the ocean water, you can feel that kind of slightly soapy, slippery feel to that water compared to fresh water you'd find in a mountain stream. Mm-hmm. And that slippery feel, that's that basic alkalinity of the ocean from all those salts.
Yeah.
Okay, how is this affecting organisms and ecosystems?
Yeah, so as we said, you know, there's more hydrogen ions in the ocean now. And essentially, when you have this extra hydrogen ion, it gobbles up carbonate. And carbonate is another ion that is negatively charged. And it basically is a necessary component of calcium carbonate, which is the basic building block of a shell or a skeleton of ocean organisms like crustaceans and mollusks, you know, clams, oysters, mussels, crabs, that kind of thing, or even corals in the tropics that have a calcium carbonate skeleton. And so as you're getting this kind of extra H plus that's gobbling up carbonate, that compromises these organisms' ability to form shells. And for organisms that have shells, it kind of weakens their shell structure and even can make them more vulnerable to predators.
And when we look at the acidity levels off the Pacific coast, how does that compare to some other places on the planet? Like I've seen, you know, we've all seen news about the coral bleaching we're observing and things like that. So how is the acidity levels off the Pacific coast compare with other places on Earth's oceans?
Yeah, so in terms of acidification, waters in California are acidifying about twice as fast as the global average. And so there is really strong upwelling in the California coastline. And that upwelling basically means that this like cold, deep, nutrient-rich, low pH water from the deep is coming up to the surface. And that is combining with this change in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as a driver to together kind of reduce the pH. And so that's one of the reasons why, in general, waters in the California coastline are quite acidic. But especially under climate change, there is an increase in acidification in the California current that's happening about twice as much as the rest of the world. So it's a big problem here specifically.
And can you tell us some of the methods you use to, you know, sample the waters? What do you do? Do you go to different places and get water samples and take them back to the lab? How do you go about determining some of this?
Yeah, it really varies. I'm a kind of computational scientist, so I tend to use a lot of data that has been kindly gathered by other people, and I kind of develop maps based on those data. There are a lot of sort of bottle samples or in-water sensors that can give, you know, kind of various types of indications that all have specific biases and drawbacks, but levels of uncertainty, but the types of sensors and sampling tends to vary, but most of the data that I do gather kind of in person tends to be bottle samples gathered from things like oceanographic cruises. And then we come back to the lab and put it through this fancy machine called a titrator to measure alkalinity, and then different types of instruments to measure pH and other kind of water quality constituents.
And then you take that data and turn it into maps, correct?
Correct.
And from your mapping, what are some of the interesting areas that you're observing? Some, maybe some surprises, things that you teased out from the data that was like, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in understanding local drivers and local variability in ocean acidification. I think that, you know, with a lot of climate science, the kind of action items that emerge from our results feel daunting, you know, to cut global carbon emissions seems a little untenable for an individual, even though every action matters. But this area next to where we live, the coastal zone right near shore, has extremely high variability, these kind of microclimates where physical conditions can vary a lot from, you know, even kilometer to kilometer or meter by meter. And so I'm really curious about how that variability leads to places where climate change, including in this case ocean acidification, is either worse or better than we would expect based on these kind of large scale regional trends. Because there are local measures that can be used to offset ocean acidification locally. And so I am really interested in my research on how freshwater quality affects ocean acidification near shore, because freshwater has a massive impact on coastal water quality. But this hasn't really been accounted for in trying to understand local scale ocean acidification. And when we're looking at, you know, kind of an endpoint, when we're looking at an aquaculture business or a fishery or a coastline where somebody, you know, likes to go free diving, that all happens at a local scale. And so the ocean acidification, kind of locally speaking, is what I'm most interested in.
What are some of the mitigation effects that could be done locally?
Yeah, so some people at Bodega Marine Lab that I work with there, they are looking at seagrass restoration as a local mitigation measure. Plants, of course, consume CO2. And so if more seagrass is restored, that can be kind of a local buffer against excessive CO2 in the ocean. And seagrass is, of course, a very important habitat for a lot of marine organisms. So it's kind of a twofer, a win-win.
Yeah, that's interesting. What are some of the big questions you're getting out of looking at the data from your mapping? What are some of the things you want to pursue going into the future?
Yeah, so I'd like to see where freshwater quality, which is something that we can control locally, where it's contributing to more acidification than we would expect, and then less acidification than we would expect. And one mechanism, for example, is too many nutrients in freshwater can lead to phytoplankton blooms in the ocean that then decompose and release CO2. So where can we reduce nutrients to have kind of an outsized benefit on mitigating ocean acidification? Those are the kinds of patterns that I'm hoping to pick up with a coastwide mapping effort to understand freshwater impacts on nearshore ocean ecosystems.
And kind of where are you at in your mapping effort? Are you still continuing to build these original maps, or have you got them in place and now it's a matter of, you know, seeing how that all changes over time?
Yeah, it's probably the latter stage. I have been lucky enough to kind of harvest a bunch of really neat data from a bunch of different hardworking organizations up and down the coast. And so the early part of this research effort was just kind of putting that all together. And now I'm seeing some cool patterns emerge, but of course we have to kind of approach things with a lot of statistical rigor. And so I'm just kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's to understand those patterns a bit better.
And what do you find most rewarding and challenging about your work as both as a researcher and, you know, kind of a newly minted PhD professor?
Yeah, I think that it, you know, my answer today is a bit different than my answer even a month ago. To be very, very blatant, there are, you know, national attacks on environmental science and on basic efforts to make science more inclusive to people who have been, frankly, shut out of science for far too long. And none of this is crazy. It's just kind of following the scientific process and making it hopefully available to all. But those kinds of efforts have been widely attacked in recent weeks, and it makes students feel very scared and vulnerable when they should be, you know, just focusing on learning. So I think that's the biggest challenge for me and for people around me. But for inspiration, I feel really lucky to be in a position where I can hopefully help students weather those storms, feel less vulnerable, feel protected and capable of kind of focusing on their research and on their learning. And, you know, Berkeley and many places, Davis, many places where I've worked are just filled with amazing, intelligent, dedicated people who provide abundant inspiration.
And did the students come to you privately to express those fears, concerns about their futures and careers? Do they come to your office hours, or how do they approach you about this? What is that kind of like?
Yeah, so it is a lot of one-on-one conversations. And I've had students, you know, kind of express doubts about whether they can pursue science as a career. And so we talk through that. And that's more of a one-on-one conversation. We also have lab meetings where we kind of open the floor for students to express any fears that they might have and talk through them as a group. So it is kind of a combination of creating space for one-on-one, more personalized conversations, and also devoting a lot of attention to building community.
And for you and your students, What are some things that actually do make you hopeful for the future, even though, you know, things are a little rough right now?
You know, I think that I'm lucky enough to have this kind of research focus on local measures that can help offset these big, scary global changes. And in focusing on that coastal variability that I just discussed, there are a lot of signs of hope. And I think that, you know, trying to map and track and better understand these bright spots, places where we might expect ocean acidification to be severe, but maybe it's doing okay. Tracking that a bit more systematically really helps give me a bit of optimism. And communities are taking action coastwide, really, really effortfully. And so I put a lot of faith in them as well.
Well, my bit of advice for your students, if I can give it to you, would be just to, you know, as best they can, have courage, because change is scary, but there's also, you know, things can change back for the better.
Thanks so much. I'll pass that on.
Well, Rachel Carlson, it's been interesting to talk to you about ocean acidification off the Pacific coast. And thanks for sharing your passion for your work and for, you know, helping your students. I really appreciate that.
I appreciate your time.
Thanks again to our guests, marine biologist and evolutionary ecologist Emily Longman from the University of Vermont, and Rachel Carlson, assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management. Both of them did research at UC Davis's Bodega Marine Laboratory. You can check out the work they do there at marinescience.ucdavis.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.